Well, joining Robert Bavall for a segment is noted author Ahmed Osman, and we're going to bring him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about things that are going on in Egypt and the pyramids. We'll get into some of Robert's research also later on in the program on Coast to Coast AM. Ahmed Osman, born and studied law, worked as a journalist in Egypt. He is a noted author, currently lives in England, spends a lot of time writing. Robert Bavall with us, of course. Robert, tell us a little bit about Ahmed, and we'll bring him in, and the three of us will chat for a little bit.
Ahmed is a very old friend of mine. We got together many, many years ago, mainly because we both were on the shooting line of Zahid Hawass. Ahmed is well known to have had huge brawls with Zahid. I think I understand he almost got into a fist fight with him once at the conference, so you may ask him that.
Okay.
Of course, Ahmed Osman is extremely well known for his books. One of his very early famous books called Stranger in the Valley of Kings. He's the one who began the various theories that biblical characters were modeled on Egyptian historical characters. He'll tell you all about it, I'm sure.
Okay.
And we now got together, by the way, to write a book about the antiquities and Zahi. So we're back in action again.
Super. Well, let's bring Ahmed in. Ahmed, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you.
And Robert's with us, too, so the three of us will just continue chatting. And you know, Ahmed, you are a very noted writer and author about ancient Egypt and biblical, as Robert was saying, biblical characters and events as well. Tell me a little bit about, and you're Egyptian as well, right?
Yes, I was born in Egypt a long time ago, and then I came to London since 1965. I still live there. Because in Egypt, I couldn't, during the Nasser period, it was not possible for me to write my books or even do any research on the subject I was working on.
Ahmed, my father was born in Cairo in 1923, and then he came to the United States a few years after that as a little boy. And
he
tells me great stories of Egypt of old, that's for sure. And his mother used to tell me, my grandmother, a lot of great stories. The situation that, with Egypt right now, are you comfortable with the direction that it's going?
The good thing is that after 63 years of military rule, Nasser started the revolution in 1952, and then came President Sadat and President Mubarak. Where they abolished all, the constitution and the parliament and the political parties. At least at last now, we got that out of that situation. Now we are calling for freedom, for democracy, for... However, because of 60 years of military dictatorship resulted in the liberal views or the general understanding of the world has been suppressed all these years. You have only one view of the government, allowed the fundamentalist Islamic groups and the political Islamic groups to develop, because they are the only people who have freedom to meet and discuss things in the mosques. Why other political groups are not allowed to act. So they have been organized, they have been suppressed, it is true, by the Mubarak security forces. However, now that the forces are off, they are in the streets and they are the only organized people, while the young people who started the revolution have not been organized. They are not in political parties. So it is having got rid of the Mubarak regime, now we are faced with a more difficult position where the liberal democratic elements of the society have to fight against the Islamic attempt to take over, to establish a political Islamic.
And
it is a new battle.
You're collaborating with Robert on a book on Zahi Hawass. Robert, let us bring you in here for a moment here. Will Zahi be happy when he reads the book?
No.
Not at all, huh?
He's not going to be happy with another book I've just published, by the way, with Tom Brophy, called Black Genesis. But, you know, I'm used to it. He's never happy with my books anyway. He's never happy with any other books that he hasn't written, so it's okay. I'd like to make a couple of comments on what...
Absolutely, I want you to join this, and Ahmed's on the line with us, so go ahead.
Yes, regarding the situation with the revolution, Ahmed is quite right. You know, for 63 years, the population of Egypt... I mean, Ahmed and I are from the what we call the Nasser generation. Both Ahmed and I were born before the 52 revolution. We were born during the monarchy, where King Farouk was still in power. And we grew up during the Nasser period, which was, although they had deposed of the monarchy, Nasser was perhaps one of the world's most powerful propaganda person. He created a propaganda machine in Egypt that practically brainwashed the population, a bit like North Korea, really.
Yeah.
And people were weaned from childhood. I mean, the generation that came after us were literally weaned from childhood with this kind of propaganda, to the point where eventually the whole credibility of the government began to disappear and fade to such an extent where people simply did not listen anymore to the government. They simply did not believe what the government was saying. And one of the most important things to realize now is that this new government, well, at least at the moment, the interim government and the military authorities that have taken over, it is extremely important. I believe it's the most important thing for this revolution, that this interim government begins to create a credible link with the people. People need to believe in what the government says. And this is one of the main problems. And taking Zahi as an example, I mean, Zahi is a typical product of this previous, before the revolution kind of mentality. You know, he dishes out anything. They say anything, and people stop believing. I mean, I must say that I just simply don't believe anything that Zahi says anymore. Mm-hmm. And I've given you a very good example earlier on, and I think Ahmed can develop this because Ahmed has actually read in Arabic. I don't read very good Arabic. The so-called decree about his appeal. Can you come in, Ahmed, on this one?
Yeah. What we heard yesterday, Ahmed, was that he was going to go to jail for 1 year because of a situation. And then today, apparently, he's got posted on his website, his blog, that he's worked out a deal and he's not going to jail and he's still going to stay in charge of antiquities. So we don't know what's going on.
Zahi is always able to confuse the issues. I mean, what he did, he appealed to the decision, court decision, and he asked the court to give him a statement that he has appealed and that he's not going to the jail now until the appeal is. What is said in Arabic. He claimed that he's made the deal or something. The court decision is still on, but he has appealed, and until the appeal is, heard, he is not going to jail. This is all what his statement says. Although he claims never says something. All his life, he claimed that he made great discoveries of the builders of the pyramids, and got the Hatshepsut mummy or whatever. I can say from my own view that Hawass never, ever made one statement that was correct about his discoveries. Mummies of tombs of the who he claims to be the pyramid builders are just tombs of people who were looking after the pyramids after when it has been already built. I mean, and his boss, Dr. Ali Hassan, told me that and told him that. But Hawass always makes things great. He wants to be a great person. From the start, Hawass created, I mean, he knew what he wanted to do. And he went to the press. He wanted to be famous so that he can say whatever he wants. And he stopped every other voice in antiquities to talk. Nobody, when I started working in Egyptology, writing about it, we had about 20 scholars, 20 people who are professors and Egyptians who talk about it, and they are reasonable. You can disagree with them. But Hawass claimed that all of them have something to do with their anti-Egyptian history. They want to falsify the history. He silenced all the voices, so he would be the only voice that can talk for Egyptian antiquity. And while since he came to back from Philadelphia to Cairo about 20 years ago, the looted antiquities in Egypt have went to a very high stage. I mean, he started to claim that he wants to get Nefertiti's head from back from Berlin and Rosetta Stone from the British Museum. I mean, just to make a case that he's a protector of antiquities, while all antiquities are smuggled out all every day from Egypt, from under his own Hawass is always false. I mean, this is the way I see him.
Somebody's making a lot of money on this.
I assure you that if you ask, he had many books published in the last few years. And if you were to ask him about any information in the books published in his name, I assure you he will never be able to answer.
Amazing. Let me ask you this, Ahmed, while we have you. Many of your books have a biblical overtone to it. Fascinating stories about what happened during the ancient days. Tell me about your work and research.
I tell you what it is. You see, when I was born, as Robert told you, we were during the Nasser period, and the main element in our life, the main event, is the conflict, the continuous conflict between Egypt and Israel. And I thought, when I was a little bit younger person, 14 or so, I was a fanatic Muslim brotherhood like this, and I wanted to go and fight and kill the Israelis. I only have either to go to paradise if I was a martyr or to kill the enemies of God. Eventually, I came to realize that the Israelis seem to have the same holy war as we have. So I wanted to know the roots of the problem. What is it? Must have something historically rooted which we are not able. So I decided to go to read the Bible and see. I mean, after all, the tribe of Israel came to Egypt as a small tribe with Joseph, the patriarch. And then Moses was born in Egypt, and the Torah, the Old Testament, the Torah, the first five books of Moses, were given to Moses in Egypt. So the Torah was given in Egypt, and the whole cornerstone of the Israelite history is the Exodus from Egypt under Moses. So I wanted to know, is this story, which is also, by the way, in the Quran, the Muslim holy book, in the same way as the Bible, is it historically correct, or is it just a mythological account? So I wanted to examine the Egyptian evidence, the archaeological evidence, against the biblical Quranic story, and whether we can identify events, biblical events and characters. And I came to the conclusion that a mummy called, or somebody called Yuya, is now in Cairo Museum, is the mummy of Joseph of the Bible.
Wow.
And then I, further on, I came to the conclusion, really, and in that Moses and Akhenaten are one and the same, the historical character of the Pharaoh Moses, who abolished different gods and said God is one with no image, is the same person as Moses of the Bible. So this is what I... obviously, Hawass was furious when he heard these things. I mean, we met, we were in Torino. I'm a member of the International Congress of Egyptology. So we met in Torino one day, and we were discussing it. He told me that they offered him $1 million to write a book about Akhenaten, and he refused. I was, I asked him, why? What's wrong with Akhenaten? So he's pretending to be a nationalistic person defending Egyptian history, and mainly to say, I mean, he's denying that the Israelites were in Egypt. I told him that is in the Quran. I don't know what Hawass is wrong with him, but what he wanted to portray himself as the protector of antiquities and the savior of Egyptian history from people like myself who claim that biblical characters can be found from Egyptian history.
And Ahmed, because he is such a believer that the Egyptians built the pyramids, would you agree with that, or do you think there was some other supernatural force involved or some kind of technology that we have since lost?
I believe that the Egyptians built the pyramids, of course. Nobody else built the pyramids. The Egyptians built the pyramids. However, I believe that those Egyptians who built the pyramids must have had a very advanced, lost technology that we no longer have. And we cannot understand, whatever way you do it, you cannot understand exactly how could they raise all these big stones and put it, millions of pieces of in different sizes and different weights, and put it in this place. It is a miracle. We never can understand. They must have had some knowledge of some kind that is lost to us now. And that's why Robert Bouval, when he came related the pyramids to some kind of mathematical understanding and related it to the position of the stars, it made sense to me. I mean Egyptologists used in the beginning to rely mainly on the written text, but now we have to include other the sciences to help us understand the past. And it is certainly those who built the pyramids were Egyptian, but how did they develop the knowledge of such a great job and the technology? We don't know.
All right. Well, that is a fascinating theory as well, Ahmed. Ahmed's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Really treat yourself to something. Look at some of his works, and I'll spell his website for those of you who aren't near a computer. It's ahmedosman.com. Ahmed, thank you, and we'll be back with more with Robert Bouval. We'll talk about his latest work, Black Genesis, get his take on that, and also, we'll talk about the pyramids on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, next hour, we'll take phone calls with Robert Bouval. Fascinating discussion of Egypt. We'll get into some of his latest work, Black Genesis, and also we'll talk a little bit about some of his original works, The Orion Mystery. We'll get his take on how he thinks the pyramids were built. I mean, I agree with him. I think the three pyramids of Giza are all lined up based on Orion's belt. No doubt about that. Let's get Robert's take on why they were built, how they were built, when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast with Robert Bouval now. And Robert, you got a good friend there with Ahmed. Sounds like you two get along real well.
We do, yes.
That's super. So you tell me about this work, Black Genesis. And you said Zahi would not like this one. How come?
Well, let me pick up on something that Ahmed said first.
Okay.
Regarding his work. It may sound unbelievable, but it's true. Zahi Hawass has literally monopolized Egyptology for the last 20 years or so. It's an incredible situation, and I am particularly baffled by other Egyptologists who have kept quiet on this. I can understand the situation in Egypt before the revolution, where the Mubarak clan and Zahi were totally in control, fully powerful, and nobody dared to challenge this. But there was a lot of Egyptologists outside Egypt, and yet they have let this happen. You know, to me it's a baffling matter. Many work have been stopped. Many good ideas have been put under the carpet, and it was all about Zahi. You know, and to me, it's a pity because so much time has been wasted. And the example of the doors, for example, in the pyramids, this story of the doors, it's an incredible story that started in 93, and we still do not know what is behind those doors. You know, to me, it's an incredible situation. I'm the only voice among very few who have been shouting to open these doors, to know what's behind them, to get this mystery over, and not a word from any Egyptologist. You know, so I really feel it's important to say this, because there's a lot of mysteries in Egypt, and particularly to do with the pyramids, that still need to be solved. But one of the things that I got involved lately, over the last 3-4 years, is Black Genesis. And now to pick on your question, why is he going to get upset? Well, Zahi, among other things, has demonstrated a rather stubborn and an aggressive view on the possibility that ancient Egypt owes its origin, or at least the impetus that started Egyptian civilization, owes its origin to an external source. Of course, there are wild theories going on. But one of the very serious investigations that has been going on for quite a long time was that Egypt civilization is rooted and possibly owes its impetus to Africa, or rather to a Black African source. And that's something that has very much interested me in the last few years, because the evidence is piling high to support that theory. Can I carry on, George?
Yeah, this is fascinating.
Right. As you recall, a group of researchers involving myself and Graham Hancock, John West, and Robert Schock, known as at the time as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, I remember, challenged the origins and age of the Egyptian civilization. In the early 1990s, John West and Robert Schock, excuse the pun, literally shocked the world when they proposed that the Sphinx, which is part of the Giza pyramid complex, was a monument that had been there much, much earlier than accepted chronology by the Egyptologists. Their argument was based on geology, to put it in simple terms. In a nutshell, they noted something that was very obvious, but surprisingly not picked up by the Egyptologists, was that the erosion on the Sphinx and on the Sphinx enclosure, which is basically vertical fissures, was obviously made by water trickling down the Sphinx and trickling down on the enclosure wall. But the kind of water that was required to cause these deep fissures is not possible with the kind of rainfalls that existed for the last 5,000 years. And the geological and climatic studies showed that this erosion must have occurred during a much more wet period, which could only have happened thousands of years before the date allocated to the Sphinx by Egyptologists. This was a very, very serious theory, but Zahi Hawass and his cronies literally jumped on the head of John West and Robert Schoch in a very, very aggressive way. They just could not tolerate the possibility that Egypt had an earlier chronology. Or let's put it this way. They could not tolerate the idea that their views were being challenged. You know, they had written the books, they had written the textbooks, they were sitting on these on their own consensus. And everything that challenged this, no matter how scientifically serious it was aggressively opposed to such an extent where all sorts of insults were being thrown in the media and so forth. I remember an extraordinary moment when Robert Schoch gave his presentation, I think it was in 1992 or 1993, if I remember well, at the Association of Geologists, the American Association of Geologists in the States. And at the end of his presentation, one supporter of Zahi Hawass, an Egyptian Egyptologist, stood up and said, "Mr. Schoch, there isn't one single Egyptologist that agrees with you." And Robert Schoch came up with the amazing phrase that I very often use. I love using it because it was so true. He looked calmly at the Egyptologist, who was absolutely furious, brandishing his hands. And he said calmly, "I do not follow the Egyptologist, sir. I follow the science." And this is what it's all about. You know, that it's come to the point where strong scientific arguments have been blocked because of the bias and political views by certain people. And Zahi, unfortunately, has been at the head of this. And I'm getting a bit excited here, George, but
that's,
you know,
right.
Me, I come from an Oriental background, so you'll have to stop me whenever you want. But in my case, you know, I come from a very, very scientific background. I'm a construction engineer. I worked for many, many years in the construction industry, using the kind of instruments that are required to understand building construction. I was working many years on building sites, using theodolites and dumpy levels and all sorts of instrumentations. I've supervised very large contracts in desert conditions. You know, I come from that kind of background. But when I proposed the Orion correlation theory, which seemed extremely logical to me, based on very, very, very strong evidence from ancient Egypt, perhaps I should give a little background to this, George.
Okay, sure.
Well, the Orion correlation theory, to put it extremely simply, is based on the idea, or rather from the evidence that comes out from the pyramid texts. The pyramid texts are inscriptions inside pyramids of the fifth dynasty that follow the builders of the Great Pyramid. In those texts, it is very clear that the motives of the builders was to build monuments that were going to assist the pharaohs in their journey towards the heavens, mm-hmm. particularly towards the stars, and to become part of a starry world, which they called the Wat, of which was ruled by the god Osiris, who was identified to the constellation of Orion. Now, inside the Great Pyramid, we were talking earlier about these shafts with the doors.
Right.
There are shafts inside the King's Chamber, the so-called top chamber, one of these shafts, the Saturn shaft, was found to point to Orion's belt at the time of the construction of the pyramid. So with that evidence, what I noted was that the layout of the three pyramids on the ground, you have two large pyramids that are aligned along a diagonal of almost the same size. The pyramids are the two large pyramids, supposedly, according to Egyptologists, built by Cheops or Khufu and his grandson Khafra, and then a third pyramid, smaller pyramid, offset to the left of this diagonal. When you look at the pattern of Orion's belt in the sky, you will see exactly the same layout. Two very bright stars, or large stars, if you like, that are along a line, with the third smaller star, or less bright star, offset to the left. It's exactly the image that you have on the ground with the pyramids.
They're perfectly aligned, aren't they?
Yes, I mean the amazing thing is that you can't deny this theory. It's there. I mean, the pyramids are there. You can't move them, and the stars are up there for everybody to see. You know, I've actually had people like Zahi saying, "No, the stars are not the same pattern." You just go out and see them.
So he'll argue with you on that too. Jeez, everything.
Sorry?
Huh? He'll argue with you about that too, huh?
You wouldn't believe what I've had to face. I mean, incredible situations of that kind. Anyway, to carry on with the correlation, the position with the pyramids on the ground are such that they form a line or a diagonal line relative to the Nile. They're on the west side of the Nile, and they angle with the direction of the Nile at about 45 degrees. That's exactly what you have with these stars when you look at them in relation to the Milky Way, which the Egyptian associated to a celestial Nile. In other words, you have a map in the sky that is mimicking exactly what you have on the ground, with the support of the texts that tell us precisely that the kings wanted to, the kings who built those pyramids wanted to actually link up with those specific stars in the sky. So the theory is an extremely solid theory. Of course, I do not have, like Zahi Hawass has, a document stamped and signed on his blog saying that King Cheops wanted to do this. But the evidence is overwhelming. And when this theory was presented in my first book, The Orion Mystery, and at the same time broadcasted on a documentary on the BBC, and I think it was a few months shown later on the Art and Entertainment Channel in the United States. Since then, it's been shown I don't know how many times in various programs. But when it was shown, it made sense to just about everybody who saw it. The only person that didn't make sense to was Hawass, you know. So. And the huge opposition by the Egyptologists. It's something that, you know, 20 years later, I'm still very baffled at this. You know, the public sees the logic in it, sees the sense in it, and yet, you know, this barrage of opposition coming from Zahi Hawass and his supporters. It's almost a bit like the... it's almost like the Spanish Inquisition, really. I mean, or the Roman Inquisition, when Galileo presented hard evidence of our planet being a globe, and those sitting in the position of authority said, no, it's not true, and that's it. So this is the situation that Egyptology has come to. When you have an autocrat running the show, when you have somebody who is totally refusing to consider any other views and blocks the system to such an extent, you're going to have what John West calls a church. You know, and this is what Egyptology has become. It's become almost a religious institution that nobody is supposed to contradict. Having said this, I don't know if you are aware of an article that was posted in the Washington Post a couple of days ago.
What was that one?
Well, it's all about Zahi. And the reporter who wrote it really got it right. He makes an extraordinary comparison with Zahi with Eva Perón.
From Argentina, you know, yeah.
Yes, the reason he does this is that now Zahi, you know, has suddenly become a pro-revolution defender. You know, and he says, I'm not for the old regime, and he's created a new
exhibition. He's a survivor, isn't he? He's a survivor, this guy.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've got in front of me Zahi's website. I've actually opened it. And in 2009, Zahi was supposed to retire. Now, the reason is that any official in Egypt who has reached the age of 63 has to retire. That's it. He has to hand over his...
That's the law.
That's the law. Now, the law applies to all officials except ministers and vice ministers.
Ah.
Those can stay till they die, like in the case of Mubarak. And so, in order for Zahi to be able to stay, something extraordinary happened in November 2009. President Mubarak created a new post of vice minister and appointed Zahi vice minister of culture. In that way, Zahi was able to stay. But let me quote this from Zahi's own website after this happened. Here is in Zahi's own words. I would like to say how grateful I am to President Mubarak. He is a unique man who has given a lot to his country. He has been in public service for years, and I have not once seen him make a decision just for himself. Everything he does for Egypt. His wife, Mrs. Suzanne Mubarak, I feel deserves a Nobel Prize for the work she has done for peace. Now, that's what Zahi said before the revolution. And now he says, I am not for the old regime, you know. So this is incredible. You know, you have one man saying one thing, and then he says another. He says we're going to open the door, then he doesn't do it. We just don't know with this man anymore. But, you know, like you say, incredibly, he is a survivor, and I have to give him that. I mean,
yeah.
he is an incredible survivor. I wonder if he is alone in surviving, though.
Well, you know, I don't know. You know, sometimes survivors like that, Robert, know things about other people. You know, they've got names and places and things, and who knows? He may be pulling that out of his hat.
Well, let me give you my take on this a bit. I'm going to Egypt on Friday. In the midst of all this conundrum and confusion.
And do be safe. Robert, we're at the top of the hour already, so we'll get into that when you come right back. Plus, I do want to get your take on how you think the pyramids were built. I want to hear it from you, and we'll take phone calls. The final hour coming up, Robert Bevall, our special guest, his website, it's his name. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's robertbevall.co.uk. And by the way, you can join up with our Facebook and our Twitter links by going to coasttocoastam.com.